The second case for oral arguments this morning is Chad Anderson, appellant versus First Century Federal Credit Union, appellee. For the appellant is Meredith Moore, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and for the appellee is Melanie Carpenter, an attorney from Sioux Falls. I would like to welcome the students from Bonham, is that correct? Welcome. Pleased that you're able to be here on such a chilly day, and I hope you find this informative. With that, Ms. Moore, you may proceed in your 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Meredith Moore, and I represent the appellant and plaintiff in this case, Chad Anderson. This appeal arises from a complaint that was brought by Mr. Anderson against his former employer, First Century Federal Credit Union in Sioux Falls. In that complaint, Mr. Anderson alleged causes of action for both constructive and wrongful discharge. He resigned from the credit union in July of 2002, and we believe the facts that led to his resignation are effectively tantamount to an actual termination. And that is why we believe that the trial court erred in summarily dismissing Mr. Anderson's claims for both constructive and wrongful discharge. In this particular case, a constructive discharge cause of action appears to be one of first impression for this court. While it has dealt with a couple of cases prior to this instance in which the underlying facts seemingly gave rise to causes of action for constructive discharge, because of various procedural issues, the actual constructive discharge cause of action was never addressed. However, the constructive discharge cause of action has been addressed extensively at the federal level, particularly in the Eighth Circuit. One of the problems, however, that I think the trial court had in analyzing the constructive discharge cause of action as alleged by Mr. Anderson was that it was focused primarily on the hostile work environment element of the constructive discharge cause of action. And there's absolutely no question that in the existing body of case law within the Eighth Circuit that there are common themes of sexual discrimination, racial discrimination, age discrimination, and sexual harassment. Those cases are replete with sensationalized facts, blatant comments, overt threats, all of those sorts of things that aren't necessarily present in the case before the court today. However, I think the trial court got caught up in that and attempted to create a mold based upon that existing constructive discharge case law. And when Mr. Anderson's facts, in case didn't fit into that mold, the trial court summarily dismissed him and decided that he had absolutely no reason whatsoever to complain about the actions which ultimately led to his resignation.
Now you say summarily. This is not then tried to a jury, it's not tried to the court, but it's disposed of by summary judgment?
That's correct.
And for the benefit of the audience today, explain the difference between summary judgment and a regular judgment where there's a court trial or a jury trial.
Certainly. In this case, Your Honor, after the discovery process was completed, the defendant in this case, First Century Federal Credit Union, made a motion for summary judgment. In other words, First Century claimed that there were no genuine issues of material fact and that they were entitled to judgment as a matter of law. In other words, that Mr. Anderson had failed to adduce sufficient evidence or present sufficient facts that would sustain his causes of action for both wrongful and constructive discharge. In making that motion, the trial court was then able to determine whether there were any genuine issues of material fact, and deciding that it saw none, dismissed his causes of action for wrongful and constructive discharge.
In order to do that, must the circuit court judge view the evidence in the light most favorable to the moving party or the non-moving party?
The trial court is required to view the evidence in a light most favorable to the non-moving party, in this case, Mr. Anderson, and to draw all inferences in the light most favorable to him. And that is another area in which we think in this particular instance that the trial court erred, because it acted not only as judge, but also as jury and the trier of fact, and it deprived Mr. Anderson of the opportunity to present his cause of action to the jury so that the jury could determine some of the issues with regard to the facts surrounding.
Most of the facts, though, really weren't in dispute, were they?
That is a fairly true statement, Justice Meyer Henry.
So what are the facts that are in dispute? It seems to me that the facts were laid out pretty clearly. There was no dispute, so then the judge was left with no other alternative but to decide as a matter of law whether those facts were sufficient to meet your case or the elements of your case.
Excuse me. I would agree with that, Justice Meyer Henry, but in this particular case, I think in applying the facts, both some of which are disputed with regard to the nature of the concerns that Mr. Anderson had about the president of the credit union, Jill Handel's, activities, I think there were certainly some disputes there as to whether there was actually wrongdoing or whether it was simply impropriety. I think there were disputes with regard to whether the investigation that the chairman of the board of the credit union, to whom Mr. Anderson took his concerns, Lee Thompson, actually conducted any type of investigation, let alone an adequate one, which was designed to go to the heart of Mr. Anderson's concerns about the highest-ranking official.
But weren't a lot of those, didn't they go to this more of a subjective test as opposed to an objective test?
There are certainly some subjective components there. However, the ultimate inquiry in this case is an objective one. It's whether a reasonable person in the shoes of the employee, in this case Mr. Anderson, would have felt that his work environment was so intolerable that he felt that he was left with little choice but to resign. And that is exactly what we believe happened in this case. And what we believe happened is that the trial court took a look at this and essentially decided that Mr. Anderson wasn't likely to prevail in front of a jury in this particular case. And because of that, the trial court ultimately decided many of those questions of fact and did not view the facts in a light most favorable to Anderson.
Did the trial court say that? Did the trial court actually say that he wouldn't prevail?
I don't believe that the trial court actually made that statement, Your Honor, but there were certainly implications within the trial court's written letter or memorandum opinion with regard to Mr. Anderson should have waited before he submitted his resignation to Ms. Handel on the morning of the board meeting, that he certainly should have waited a little longer, that they certainly didn't see that there was any reason for him not to have waited out the board meeting to see if the board would actually address his concerns, would actually raise those concerns with the president of the credit union, and then would actually come back and indicate to him that your job will be safe. And I think that in doing that, the trial court again decided that it was likely that perhaps a jury would never believe that Mr. Anderson shouldn't have resigned. But I think that's a question for the jury as to whether Mr. Anderson's resignation was in fact precipitous or not.
So the evidence that was presented to support a summary judgment, was that all by deposition, affidavits? What kind of evidence did the trial court have before?
The trial court had several deposition transcripts, Mr. Anderson's deposition transcript, Lee Thompson, the chairman of the board of directors for First Century Federal Credit Union, two other board members' deposition transcripts, Cecilia Grunwald and Dick Devaney, the deposition transcript also of Greg Beckman, another board member, and there were also several affidavits that were submitted throughout the course of the trial, one in connection with a particular motion to compel hearing to obtain certain records that had not been disclosed by the Federal Credit Union in discovery. Additionally, there were some records that were submitted to the court under seal, and those records came from the National Credit Union Administration, which is the body that ultimately bears responsibility for overseeing a credit union's actions and determining whether it is in fact in compliance with the law. And in this case, following Mr. Anderson's resignation, he made what's called a fraud hotline call or submitted a suspicious activity report to the National Credit Union Administration, essentially bringing forth again what his primary concerns were about Jill Handel and her activities. Based on that fraud hotline call, the National Credit Union Administration then came in to investigate the allegations made by Mr. Anderson, and they produced several examination reports. Those documents were submitted under seal to the court, They indicate what type of investigation the examiner, Misty Potter, in this case, actually conducted, and what her findings were of the various things in which she looked at. And in this particular case, they looked at the accounts of Jill Handel as well as her family members, because that, of course, was the crux of Mr. Anderson's complaint to the NCUA. So the trial court also had in front of it specific documents from the National Credit Union Administration so that it could actually see whether Mr. Anderson's concerns regarding Jill Handel's activities in this case were in fact warranted and well-founded. Additionally, the trial court had in front of it the deposition of Misty Potter, who was the NCUA investigator who came in and conducted that suspicious activity investigation. And she, too, substantiated Mr. Anderson's concerns in this case. And his concerns were, of course, about the activities of the president. He noticed significant amounts of money going in and out of her account, late-night withdrawals, loans that were being made to her family members, the proceeds of which appeared to be not going directly into the family member's account, but directly into the account of Jill Handel herself. And those are the types of things that he noted and that he believed to be potentially not only in violation of internal credit union policies, but also in violation of the rules and regulations promulgated by the National Credit Union Administration itself.
Well, assuming that is, you know, that's all true, he was not fired, though. You have to get the next step that it was such an environment that caused him to be to resign rather than wait and be fired, which is usually the case. And there was no indication that he was about to be fired, is there? Do you have evidence of that?
I would disagree with that, Justice Meyer-Henry. In this particular case, we do believe that there was evidence that would support Mr. Anderson's ultimate resignation. It's undisputed he resigned. But the constructive discharge claim can rely upon a compelled resignation in order to properly state a wrongful discharge claim, which is, of course, premised upon the idea that the employer's motivation in the termination or the discharge is, in fact, in contravention of public policy.
Can you step me through the evidence that is support taken in the light most favorable to your client that supported that?
Certainly. In this particular case, Chad Anderson in January of 2002 was approached by Judy Wickery, the head teller at the credit union. She pointed out some of these concerns that she was noticing. The late night dollar withdrawals, ATM withdrawals, excuse me, the large amounts of money going through. They decided to watch that. They initially thought that the regular credit union examination would yield discovery of these particular irregularities that they were noting. It didn't. So in May of 2002, they went to see the chairman of the board. They decided that as members of a financial organization institution, they owed a fiduciary duty to its members to approach the board of directors. They approached Lee Thompson. They told him of their suspicions. He asked for documentation with regard to what their concerns were, and he essentially praised them for bringing this to his attention and told them he'd investigate it. However, after that, there's certainly a question as to whether if he did anything to properly investigate Anderson and Wickery's concerns or if he really ever delved into them whatsoever. And what happened in the interim was that Anderson and Wickery continued to notice the same type of pattern of suspicious and unusual activity on the part of Jill Handel. The work environment was stressful to the extent that she was coming and going. There were strange things going on. Chad Anderson testified that he believed that she was aware that they may have been watching her. And what you have here is all of these events leading up to the morning of July 1 of 2002. And at that time, Anderson has repeatedly been in contact with Chairman Lee Thompson, inquiring as to what efforts he has made to investigate this. And Chairman Thompson, in his deposition, essentially testified, "I didn't need to tell Mr. Anderson anything. I simply told him we were working on it." And Mr. Thompson also testified that Anderson was agitated. He was anxious, he was nervous, he wanted answers. So it certainly was no surprise that Chad Anderson was very concerned about what was going on. And Mr. Anderson testified that every day he remained at that credit union and every day he believed that a proper investigation was not being made into these facts, he was tacitly approving of what he believed to be wrongdoing. And so what you have then is Jill Handel somehow ultimately finds out that Anderson and Wickery have essentially been watching her bank accounts and have been watching her activities and have these suspicions. She goes to Cecilia Grunewald and Dick Devaney, two members of the board, tell them this, and basically says, I think they're conspiring to get my job. They then contact Lee Thompson, and there's some dispute as to the exact time frame at the that the contact was made, but it's undisputed that there was contact between Jill Handel, Cecilia Grunewald, Dick Devaney, and Lee Thompson, where they indicated that they knew that Anderson was watching Handel, and they knew that he had suspicions about her. And at that point in time, Thompson called up Anderson and said, it's going to hit the fan, heads are going to roll, she knows, something's going to happen. Anderson at this point, of course, knows this doesn't bode well for him. He doesn't believe any investigation of any sort has been done at this point. He knows that other board members believe that he is conspiring against Jill Handel to essentially get her job and may have manufactured some of these complaints. And he certainly has received absolutely no assurance from Chairman Thompson whatsoever that his job is going to be protected. In fact, Chairman Thompson effectively tells him when Anderson says, what do I do? I'm not sure what to do. Chairman Thompson tells him, you do what you have to do. There's certainly no representation there on the part of Chairman Thompson that don't go into work today. I'll make sure that you're protected. I'll make sure that your side of the story is told. This is the first time at which all of the facts are essentially being revealed to certain members of the board because Chairman Thompson has decided not to tell any of the other members of the board at this point in time. And Anderson felt that he had no choice but to resign. And one of the particular key components of the law of constructive discharge is that an employee is also justified in resigning if that employee believes that he or she has no chance of being accorded fair treatment after having given an employer an opportunity to investigate or to address the problem of which the employee originally obtained.
But wasn't the board meeting that morning, the morning he resigned? They were meeting on this issue, and he didn't even wait for the board to make a decision.
That's correct. They weren't.
Well, isn't that objectively unreasonable to not at least wait until the board meeting that day to decide whether you're going to quit or not?
I don't believe so, Justice Center. I think that's ultimately a question of fact that should be posed to the jury, is whether Mr. Anderson's resignation was precipitous. But I think that goes back to that key element of the constructive discharge law, that at this point in time, Anderson believes that the board is essentially against him. And they believe that, and he didn't believe he would be accorded fair treatment at that point.
His belief, but I mean, you conceded earlier, his subjective belief isn't what's material here.
That's correct.
It's what an objective view would show.
That's correct.
What a reasonable person would think.
Whether or not his belief was reasonable, correct?
That's correct. It's whether a person in the same or similar circumstances would effectively have felt that they had no choice but to resign. And I believe under these particular circumstances, when a subordinate employee has levied what are fairly significant allegations against his superior and believes that that superior is effectively doing something wrong, and you're talking here not just about a superior at work, but also someone who he's known for many years, someone who's been an employee of that credit union for approximately 20 years, and what most of the board members believe to have been a very good employee of that credit union for 20 years, up until the point in time at which she was terminated following Anderson's resignation himself.
He did receive a favorable performance review from the president, though, didn't he?
That's correct.
And this was around the same time that these allegations were becoming known to her?
That's correct.
And he was aware of that. He was aware the performance review was favorable.
Yes, the performance review was given in approximately June of 2002, I believe in about the second week, and the events that really the culmination of the events occurred in about the last 2 weeks of June, going into that July 1st date on which everyone learned essentially that there was common knowledge of Anderson's concerns and that they had been raised, and that at that point in time, Handel was going to be the board and that it was going going to be addressed.
Did she eventually make everything right with the credit union by restoring the funds and getting the loans paid off and eliminating the favoritism that she had exhibited to her family?
I'm not sure if everything was ever resolved. It certainly appears from looking at the account statements that we were able to obtain that the existing lines of credit were paid off. There were certainly numerous loans that the NCUA flagged or earmarked in its investigation that related to the family members and her boyfriend with regard to them being under-collateralized.
However, did she eventually resign herself or be terminated?
She was terminated by the credit union in November of 2002, following a completion of the investigation by the National Credit Union Administration.
Prior to that, had she terminated one of the people who were the whistleblowers or one of the people who participated with the two whistleblowers?
Correct. Judy Wickery was actually terminated later the same day that Mr. Anderson resigned. She was terminated, well, she was effectively given the opportunity to resign or be terminated, and she was ultimately terminated under the guise that she had disclosed confidential member information to Lee Thompson.
But that's not material because he had already resigned. He could not have relied on that fact.
That's correct, because
that's
that did
true, but it's something to be considered as an issue of fact for the jury as to whether there's a genuine issue of material fact as to what the atmosphere was at that time.
I think that's very true, Your Honor, because it certainly goes to the totality of the circumstances, and I think that's one of the things that the trial court ignored in this particular context, again looking primarily at whether the environment was so hostile that it failed to look outside of that and look to Judy Wickery and also to Matt Peary.
Your time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Carpenter, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. Judge Teede properly applied the rules relating to summary judgment in this case and properly granted summary judgment. Chad Anderson voluntarily resigned his employment with First Century Federal Credit Union. He cannot prove any wrongful discharge in this case, firstly, because he cannot prove he was constructively discharged. Both of the parties in this case agree what the law is with regard to constructive discharge and what factors Mr. Anderson must satisfy before he can establish a constructive discharge. Those are that he must establish First Century intentionally created an intolerable working conditions for him, that they did this for the purpose of forcing him to quit or knowing that this would result in his resignation, and that these working conditions were so intolerable that a reasonable person would not they'd feel no other choice but to resign in that situation. Judge Teede accepted all of the facts presented by Anderson as true, and he indulged every reasonable inference in favor of Anderson. He found there was no evidence of constructive discharge. The facts in this case are what plaintiff himself has alleged and testified to. This is a somewhat unusual situation in that we have Chad Anderson, who is the plaintiff. He is setting out and dictating what the facts of this case are, because the other party to a lot of these conversations, a lot of this relationship, Jill Handel, died shortly after all of these allegations were made. So we don't know what her side of the story is, and we're bound by what Mr. Anderson is telling us the story is. So it's a little different. We don't even have two sides to the story. We have one side, and that's Mr. Anderson's side. And even under all the facts as he set forth, he cannot establish an actionable claim for constructive discharge or wrongful discharge in this case.
He can't be punished or things cannot be viewed against his position just because one of the key participants passed away after the lawsuit was started, right?
That's true. That's true, Your Honor. All I'm saying is that we are indulging, Judge Teede did indulge every reasonable inference in his favor. There is no other inference because
I don't know, it kind of sounded like you were claiming that he didn't have to because of her death.
No, that's not what I was saying. I apologize.
Also, though, it's a reasonable person standard, and which usually does go to the jury. Why shouldn't it go to the jury here? Because everybody's, they're arguing on on whether, I mean, somebody, he talks to somebody, he said heads are going to roll. Aren't those all issues that would go to the reasonable person, how they would feel under those circumstances, and why shouldn't the jury hear that?
Because, Your Honor, Justice Meyer Henry, in this case, we can look at all the facts as he's set them forth, and no reasonable jury could ever find that a reasonable person in Mr. Anderson's condition would have felt the need to resign his employment. There is no need to go farther. We have to grant summary judgment in these situations. That's what the law is. If we look at the facts, we are dealing with a 5-week time period at best. Mr. Anderson came forward with his allegations to the chairman of the board, Lee Thompson, on May 22nd of 2002. He resigned July 1st of 2002, and he was gone on vacation during one of those weeks and wasn't even present in the credit union. So all of this bad conduct that created this horrible work environment for him had to take place during that time frame. The only individual at the credit union who knew anything about his allegations against Ms. Handel was Lee Anderson. The individual who the allegations were directed at, Jill Handel, was unaware until only shortly before he resigned. She didn't harass him or treat him any differently than any other employee. And in fact, she did give him a favorable employment review in late June of 2002. Thompson didn't create an intolerable work condition for Mr. Anderson. What did he do? When Anderson came to him, he said, "Thank you for bringing this to my attention. I will handle it. I'll look into it. I'll maintain your confidentiality." Because in the event that there really wasn't anything going on, they wanted these people to be able to continue to work together. This is a small institution that carries around 10 employees. So everyone kind of knows everyone else's lives, their business. That was one of the reasons he was trying to maintain the confidentiality. When Mr. Anderson would call, Mr. Thompson would tell him, "I'm looking into it, I'm investigating," would reassure him that he was still looking into the matter. Anderson acknowledges no one told him to resign, no one threatened him. No one told him he'd be terminated or demoted or disciplined. No one led him to believe his job was in jeopardy whatsoever, and that's by Mr. Anderson's own testimony.
Did he admit, though, he said the heads are going to roll?
What, if you look at the record in Mr. Anderson's deposition, when you read it, he said, what happened? The question was, what was the conversation when Lee Thompson had called him the morning before he resigned? And Mr. Anderson said, Mr. Thompson told Mr. Anderson, Jill Handel found out about the allegations. She found out someone said heads are going to roll. So it was more, this is what Jill had been told, that heads are going to roll, you know, things are going to come crashing down.
At least that was his version, right?
That's Mr. Anderson's.
Okay. All right.
That's in Mr. Anderson's deposition testimony. I think if you read that, that is what his understanding of the conversation and how he relayed the conversation with Mr. Thompson.
So Anderson is referencing Jill saying heads are going to roll, referring to her head or his head?
Her head. I think what he's referring to is that Thompson said, Jill found out about this. Someone said heads are going to roll, meaning Jill's head is going to roll. And, you know, she's the implication she'd be terminated, you know, later that week or whenever they had their board meeting. And Jill found out through one of her employees came to her and said, yeah, you know, people are talking, this is what I'm hearing, heads are going to roll, that type of thing. And, you know, notwithstanding that fact, she knew her personal account information had been disseminated. She knew that people had been meeting behind her back regarding her account information and monitoring her account information. But, you know, when Mr. Anderson came in that morning and tendered his resignation, she didn't snatch it up and say, thank goodness, now I don't have to fire you myself. She said,
isn't that a spin that you and the circuit court judge, though, are putting on this evidence when obviously Chad Anderson's version is the opposite? I've never known until now that anyone was implying that Jill Handel was saying her head was going to roll until you've just expressed that position. Isn't that a jury question to be determined?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think if you go back and read Mr. Anderson's deposition testimony, it's pretty clear that that comment, heads are going to roll, was Lee Thompson saying this is what Jill had heard. And, I mean, we can go back and reread the testimony, but I think it's pretty clear that that is what he was testifying to at the time, not that Thompson was saying everyone's heads are going to roll, you know, it's all blowing up. I don't think that's a fair reading of Mr. Anderson's own testimony in this case.
Were there rules? Did they have policies or rules or regulations? Is it in the record that they had policies or rules or regulations dealing with any kind of a procedure with somebody, a whistleblower, or somebody presenting some evidence that was or some complaint about questionable financial dealings? Was there an internal rule of any sort?
I think, Your Honor, there was, but that's not part of the record here. You know, in addition, Mr. Anderson has made all these admissions that no one was harassing him, no one was making his job more difficult, you know, during this five-week period. No one told him you shouldn't have reported your suspicions. No one harassed him, gave him unreasonable job requirements. And he can't claim a better version of the facts than what he's testified. He has testified that he wasn't constructively discharged, in essence, by admitting all of these facts. And he can't come in now, after the fact, and try to create some other inference based on extraneous facts after he already testified to the important issues in this case. Now, again, when he claims there's some subjective belief that Jill would terminate him after she found out about the report, an objective person wouldn't feel that way because Jill didn't terminate him or didn't tell him, I'm glad you're resigning. She told him, wait until after the board meets today. You know, an objective person in that situation would not have thought that their job was in jeopardy. And Mr. Anderson's counsel has indicated that there was the board members, that he believed board members were conspiring, that the board members thought he was conspiring to get Ms. Handel's job. And there's just no evidence of that in the record. Ms. Handel came to the few of the board members with her concerns that her employees were talking about her. They asked for her records, her personal banking records. They went over the information. They scheduled a board meeting for first thing the following workday, right away in the morning. At that board meeting, they called their outside accountant to come in and talk to them about providing an audit. There is no evidence that they thought, oh, this is all just something that Chad Anderson has fabricated. They were taking these allegations seriously, and they were going to address them at that board meeting on July 1st of 2002, the board meeting that Chad Anderson couldn't wait to see what would happen. He resigned before even waiting to see what was going to occur at that time. Now, there has been criticism by Mr. Anderson about the investigation in this case. Mr. Thompson undertook an investigation to try to create the least amount of upheaval within this small institution. Jill Handel had been with this credit union for 22 years. She was well-liked, well-respected, not only in the institution, but also among credit unions, the industry in general.
Remind me again how much time frame transpired from the time he contacted Mr. Thompson and the time this all played out.
He contacted Mr. Thompson on May 22nd of 2002, and he resigned July 1 of 2002, so roughly 5 weeks.
And what date did he turn over the documentation of the violations of the credit union policy?
The documentation, from what I recall of the record, was turned over around close to the last week in June of 2002. And it was when Mr. Anderson was on, it was turned over, and then he had essentially went on vacation for that last week. But there was an investigation done by Mr. Thompson, and he did take these allegations seriously. The first thing he did was he called the regulatory agency and asked them about the allegations. And they had just been to the credit union doing one of their yearly examinations. And he asked the examiner, and said, what do you think of these allegations? And the examiner said, well, it sounds like you have some disgruntled employees. And he said, really left him with the impression that there was nothing to worry about and that the allegations were without merit, that Mr. Thompson didn't need to do anything further with regard to the allegations as far as the NCUA was concerned. Now, when your regulatory agency tells you that's meritless, you know, a lot of people would stop there, but he didn't. He continued on with his investigation. He tried to get this into the hands of the supervisory committee of the credit union, and the supervisory committee is a committee that will examine allegations such as this, fraud allegations. They will do the internal and in-house examination to see if there's any merit to this. And the supervisory committee is made up of one board member and two essential lay people or members of the credit union themselves. And those, he called Warren Anderson the chair, and he'd just been appointed to the U.S. Marshal, so he was unavailable. So essentially, due to the timing of the matter, they were just without the supervisory committee at that time. He also called their outside accounting firm, the person who had just done an audit that spring.
But none of the... The problem is that Mr. Anderson didn't know that that was all going on. Isn't that right?
That's true, Your Honor.
So what he was doing doesn't necessarily, and you have to look at the environment from Anderson's perception to a certain extent, don't you? I mean, he's a whistleblower. It takes a lot to complain about your boss maybe doing something illegal. Then he doesn't hear anything back for, 6 weeks or something like that. And then when he does, he still is getting the impression that nothing's going to happen to the person he complained about, but that it might happen to himself. I mean, what was actually happening isn't really important, is it? I mean, why is that material to the environment? Because that environment is not what was perceived, nor was he able to perceive that any of this was going on. It was the secretiveness of it that caused him concern. That's what he's complaining about. He did the whistleblowing, and then he doesn't hear anything. And when he does, it's like somebody's going to get fired.
I think, Your Honor, again, we have to look at this with an objective standard, not the subjective beliefs of Chad Anderson. What would an objective person feel in that situation? An objective person, I submit to you, would trust the chairman of the board of the institution to complete this investigation. And when he checked back in with Mr. Thompson, which he did on a regular basis, Mr. Anderson was told by Mr. Thompson that he was investigating. Now, Chad Anderson's subjective belief that this wasn't actually going on, his choice not to believe the chairman of the board of directors, that can't govern here. Mr. Thompson also had obligations to the membership, to Jill Handel, to maintain some secrecy in conducting this investigation. He would have all sorts of other issues if he went out and paraded all this information that he was learning to Mr. Anderson. So I don't think the fact that he told Mr. Anderson, yes, I am looking into this, for a reasonable person, that would be enough. Mr. Anderson says it wasn't enough for him. Well,
the whole point, though? Isn't that the determination of the fact finder, the jury, to determine whether or not whose head will roll, or whether or not what he observed was reasonable in his mind. That's a standout jury question in my mind.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with that. I think that no jury would find that he was placed in an intolerable work condition. We can't let employees dictate the manner of these investigations, which is essentially what we'd be doing. I mean, the institution has to have some ability to call the shots as to how they're going to handle these internal investigations, how they're going to deal with business decisions, and if we're going to say, well, we have to, you know, tell Chad Anderson every step we take, and then he's going to say, well, why don't you do this or that to make me feel better? You know, that's not reasonable. We have to look at what the facts are. The facts are no one threatened him. No one made his workplace bad or intolerable. And the other thing we have to look at is there has to be some causal connection between this alleged whistleblowing and the alleged constructive discharge. If there's no connection between the two, then there's no cause of action. And there is no connection. He can't say, well, because I'm a whistleblower, you didn't investigate fast enough, or you didn't investigate to my liking. I mean, the whole purpose of the wrongful discharge statute is to prevent people from firing them for doing a certain act that's protected. Here, he engaged in his protected act. No one took any adverse or bad actions towards him as a result of his whistleblowing. They did nothing but reassure him that what he did was appropriate and reasonable. And for that fact, Your Honors, we think that the circuit court judge properly granted summary judgment, and we would ask for your affirmance. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Carpenter. Ms. Moore, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you. A jury should hear this case. I think both Justice Meyer Henry and Justice Sabers hit it on the head. And the federal courts have specifically admonished against granting summary judgment in employment law cases. And that's typically because in the employment law context, cases turn on inferences and indirect evidence. And a lot of the factual disputes that you've heard bantered about between the two attorneys here today are just that, questions of fact that should be presented to a jury. And one of those questions is, what was reasonable for Anderson to believe? And his subjective viewpoint has to be looked at to a certain extent in this particular case, because a jury would have to step into Anderson's shoes and decide whether, knowing what he knew at the time and what he knew under these circumstances and what he knew about what Chairman Thompson was doing to investigate his concerns, and what he knew about Jill Handel's actions, and actions that he believed to be in violation of rules and potentially damaging to the members of a credit union for which he was an employee, all of those things are relevant. And all of those things go to a determination of whether a juror in his shoes at that time, knowing what he knew, would have felt compelled to resign under the circumstances. You've heard a great deal of discussion with regard to what Chairman Thompson did in this case and the fact that certainly he took this seriously and certainly he investigated that. And certainly it should have been done under secrecy given that we were, in fact, looking at the president of the credit union. Well, I think that's a very disingenuous argument because, quite frankly, he told no one. He didn't go to the board. He didn't tell anyone else on the board. He contacted Larry Wirt, the former NCUA investigator who had conducted the annual examination, and who said, it looks like you have some disgruntled employees here. But that certainly wasn't borne out in the results of the NCUA investigation, special investigation that was later conducted by Misty Potter. They certainly found that there were certainly things here that should have been brought to someone's attention. And I think there's a significant question under this set of facts as to whether had an employee within the credit union not gone to Jill Handel and said, there are some employees who have some concerns about your actions in this particular instance, I think there's a question as to whether Chairman Thompson would have ever taken this to the board. Because it appears that the only reason that that board meeting was in fact scheduled was because Jill Handel went to two other board members and said, something's going on here that needs to be addressed. Absent that contact, one has to question, how long would Chairman Thompson have actually looked at this particular situation and whether he simply would have blown it off?
Well, and Mr. Thompson's conduct, though, or failure to act, maybe, doesn't suggest intentionally creating a hostile work environment. At best, it doesn't just reflect that he may have been negligent or failed to move fast enough on this. It doesn't suggest intentional conduct. At least you haven't identified anything suggesting what he failed to do was intentional.
However, under the existing law for both constructive and wrongful discharge, the employer doesn't have to intentionally force the employee to resign. Numerous cases in the Eighth Circuit have also held that if the employee's resignation is reasonably foreseeable to the employer under the circumstances, that in and of itself is the same thing as satisfying the intent requirement. And in this particular case, when Anderson first went to Thompson back in May of 2002 and told him about these particular concerns, he said, I'm here because I'm worried, and if you think that I want Jill Handel's job, I'll give you my resignation right now. He told Thompson every time he talked to him between May and July that he was concerned about what was going on, that it made him very nervous, very agitated, that when he saw these loans and feared they were being used to cover up delinquencies, when he saw loans being taken out in the name of family members and transferred into her own account, he thought, certainly, I bear some responsibility in this as well if this isn't borne out. And when Thompson specifically testified in his deposition that I knew Anderson was agitated, that I knew he was nervous, he told me on numerous occasions that he would resign. That certainly was reasonably foreseeable then that under the circumstances on July 1st of 2002, that Anderson's resignation wasn't a surprise. And by not taking any steps to assure Anderson that his job would be protected, or to assure Anderson that he would make sure that his story and that his version of events and that his concerns were brought out to the credit union, Anderson had no reason to believe that Thompson was going to do anything to assist him at that point in time. And that should be a question for the jury as to whether his actions on that particular morning were in effect reasonable. One of the other things that I think is of key significance that was focused on earlier was the heads are going to roll testimony. And Anderson specifically testified in his deposition about a conversation that he was in fact having with Lee Thompson, about a conversation that Jill Handel had had, but Anderson specifically testified he didn't know whose head was going to roll. He thought it could be his. He thought it could be Wickery's. He thought it could be Handel's. He didn't know what it meant, and he specifically stated, I panicked. And so in that regard, again, I think that's a question for the jury as to what that particular comment meant. And certainly under the circumstances, it was reasonable to believe that Anderson was going to be in a significant amount of trouble for having disclosed certain confidential information to the chairman of the board of directors in this case, which was certainly reasonable under the circumstances. I think ultimately here, there is a causal connection between Anderson's concerns, between telling Thompson about the concerns that he had, and between his resignation. To claim otherwise is simply an untenable argument that compartmentalizes every portion of this case and doesn't look at the totality of the circumstances. Anderson saw certain things going on in Jill Handel's account that he was concerned about that either violated the National Credit Union rules or perhaps some internal policies which were quite frankly very lacking and weren't in fact developed until after all of this came to a head in November of 2002. He reported those particular acts. In this case, or excuse me, this court held in Dahl versus Combined Insurance that there's certainly no greater public policy interest than that of protecting the property interests of society and that of ensuring that employees have protection for discussing either illegal or even unsafe practices with a higher up. And that's exactly what Anderson did in this particular case.
Do you have any stronger evidence other than the testimony of your own client that what happened to him was an intolerable working condition?
I think that his testimony bears that out. I think when you look at that in connection with Matt Peary's testimony, who was also employed at the credit union, with whom Chad Anderson was talking at the time, Matt Peary talked about how it was very tense in the credit union, about how there were other employees talking about how things needed to change. You had these two individuals who knew very well their employer, Jill Handel, and were concerned about these allegations. You also have then, in looking to the forward, but obviously looking at the totality of the circumstances, the deposition testimony of Misty Potter, who indicated that there were numerous things that Jill Handel was doing as the president of this credit union that gave her significant concern and that she thought were wholly improper. And when you put all of those things together, you're looking at the vice president of the credit union here, Mr. Anderson being the second highest ranking member of a financial institution which owes a fiduciary duty to its members. He saw these things going on. He didn't believe anything was being done to investigate, to stop them, to take any of those reasonable efforts. And he thought he was effectively tacitly approving this type of illegal or, at best, improper activity on the part of Ms. Handel. And I think that whether his resignation was precipitous, whether Chairman Thompson's investigation was adequate, if we would say otherwise, but all of those things are questions for the jury. And that's why in the majority of these cases, a jury has been allowed to take a look at them, and it has been allowed to determine under the circumstances whether the employee acted reasonably. And in this case, we believe Mr. Anderson has adduced sufficient evidence to present his claims to a jury, and we would ask that this court look at the totality of the circumstances and to view all of the facts in a light most favorable to Anderson, which we certainly don't think happened in this case, and to reverse and remand for a jury trial.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.